The court calls United States versus Arellanos Portillo 23-165, and we'll hear from Mr. Rachebeau.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Jake Rachebeau on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Arellanos Portillo. When the district court applied an aggravating role adjustment to the guideline calculation for Mr. Arellanos Portillo's money laundering counts, it did so based almost exclusively on his role in the drug distribution scheme. In doing so, the district court plainly applied an incorrect standard. Although the general rule is that a Chapter 3 adjustment may be based on any relevant conduct, Application Note 2C in the money laundering guideline expressly provides an exception that any Chapter 3 adjustment must be based on the defendant's role in the money laundering scheme and not on the underlying unlawful activity. Because there's a reasonable probability that the district court would not have applied a three-level aggravating role adjustment under the correct standard, this court should remand for resentencing. Now, to be clear, the error is that the district court applied an incorrect standard. Whether the record contains sufficient evidence to apply the enhancement has nothing to do with the error that Mr. Arellanos Portillo is alleging here. It is simply that in assessing whether the enhancement should apply, the district court did so under the incorrect standard, considering whether he was a manager or supervisor in the drug distribution conduct, as opposed to limiting it to the money laundering conduct.
Can we consider sufficiency of evidence and essentially make that finding for ourselves on appeal, or would it require a remand if you're correct about the law?
I'm sorry, could you ask the question again, Your Honor?
Yes, I understand your point that the role adjustment has to be for the money laundering, for a money laundering calculation. The government is saying, but there's all this evidence in the record that in fact there were five participants and that your client did direct at least one of the participants. So even if the district court didn't find that, you, the 10th Circuit, go ahead and read the record. You'll see it's all there. Please affirm. Is there a problem doing that legally?
Yes, there's several problems with that. And first of all, I do want to be clear that just the sufficiency of the evidence is not the appropriate standard for this court to look to under whether it's error, whether it's, you know, second prong, third prong, fourth prong. The legal sufficiency of the evidence is not the correct standard for this court to look to. The standard for harmlessness is whether there's a reasonable probability of a different outcome on remand.
But we're not dealing with harmlessness, are we? We're dealing with prong three of plain error, which is your burden.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. And I guess sometimes I generally refer to, think of third prong as sort of the harmlessness analysis for plain error. But yes, it's my burden. It's the defendant's burden to prove that there's a reasonable probability of a different outcome below. But it's not sufficiency, and it's not preponderance either. A reasonable probability is something less than the preponderance of the evidence standard. And if this court was inclined to affirm on alternative grounds that the government is advocating for, that is alternatively finding that there were, you know, other participants. But mainly it's new argument that the money laundering was otherwise extensive. That is in fact an alternative ground, and this court only affirms on alternative grounds if they can make that determination as a matter of law. And whether the money laundering was otherwise extensive is a factual finding that the district court reviews, or that this court reviews, for generally under clear error. So in order to turn this clear error determination into an error of law, this court could only affirm on alternative grounds if it would find that a failure to apply, find that it was otherwise extensive, was clear error as a matter of law. And under this record and under the argument the government has made, this court can't hold that as a matter of law, it would be clearly erroneous for the district court to find that this wasn't otherwise extensive.
Mr. Rachebeau, without regard to whether it's otherwise extensive, with regard to whether there are five or more participants, do you challenge the premise, I think, that the government has implicitly, that you aggregate the participants that are involved in the April 27th, 28th trip and the July trip? I mean, in other words, you have Mr. Peral in the July trip. You have other participants, I think Mr. Cabral, I believe, in the April trip. Do you look at do you look at the individuals that are involved in the April trip and the July trip, add them together and see whether there are five or more participants?
Yes, Your Honor, if you consider them all part of the same money laundering scheme, I think that would be a fair thing to do. To be honest, that hadn't occurred to me under right now. I've been operating on assumption that, yes, you can combine them. I think that is a fair reading of Application Note 2C. It's not that you can't consider any relevant conduct whatsoever. It's just that for each money laundering count, the Chapter 3 adjustment has to be based on the money laundering activity. Here, I think it would be fair to say that the money laundering activity of each of those two counts are relevant conduct that can be considered, as opposed to the relevant conduct of the drug trafficking counts.
You clearly, if you add them all up, you clearly have five or more participants. I mean, you have Mr. Calzada, you have Mr. Pallone, you have Claudia when she's finding the cash in the garage, you have the defendant, you have Mike. I mean, you just add them up and you clearly have more.
Your Honor, I perhaps misunderstood your question. I didn't mean to suggest that it's okay to include Claudia and Mike in that calculation. I thought you meant the
But let me ask you about Claudia. You know, she's obviously dealing drugs, and she's keeping drugs and she's keeping cash in the garage. And then the defendant is trying to make the delivery in July. And he's trying to find the cash to go have transported to have to Mike's courier. And who does he have to find the cash? It's Claudia in her garage. So how is Claudia, knowing where the cash is, leads the defendant to the cash in her garage? How can she not be considered a participant in the money laundering? She's the one that gives the cash to the defendant.
I understand, Aaron, but by that logic, then, you know, every drug customer, every single person in the drug trafficking context, they all play some part in getting money to then be laundered. But there has to be the distinction between the money laundering conduct and the drug distribution conduct. Claudia, and in order to be a participant, you actually have to be criminally responsible for that activity. So the evidence in the record is only that Claudia told Mr. Arias Portillo where the money was, and then he told her that he was going to Wichita. That alone does not make Claudia criminally responsible for money laundering. The money laundering is the transportation of the money to Mexico from a place inside the United States to a place outside of the United States for the purpose of carrying on specified unlawful activity. So just because there are these players who are involved in the drug distribution, which necessarily entails money, you have the money from the drug sales and you have to put them somewhere, the money and the drugs, you know, they all go in these stash houses. But the actual money laundering conduct, as distinct from the drug trafficking conduct, is the transportation of that money to Mexico, which did not necessarily involve Claudia. And again, the district court did not find that Claudia was a participant at all, let alone a participant in the money laundering scheme. And you know, it would be improper for this court to find in the first instance to make that factual finding that Claudia was involved, when what really this court needs to be concerned with whether there is a reasonable probability that the district court could find that she's not a participant. And there is a reasonable probability that she's not a participant, given that, as far as the evidence shows, she knew where the money was and told Mr. Arias Portillo where it was, and he said he was going to Wichita.
Why do you accept the district courts, including the drug stash house, as part of the money laundering calculation? Two levels there. Separate question, isn't it? Or isn't that supposed to be decided under the drug guideline calculation?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, the maintaining a premise enhancement?
That has no business in the drug or in the money laundering calculation, does it?
My understanding, and you're right, I haven't challenged this on appeal. My understanding is that you incorporate, so the money laundering guideline is, the base offense level is in two parts. Subsection A1 is for direct money launderers who are involved in the underlying criminal activity and also the money laundering. And then the next A2 is for just so-called third party money launderers who aren't involved in the underlying criminal activity. For subsection A1, the base offense level is the base offense level for the underlying criminal activity. And my understanding is that you do incorporate the base offense level as well as specific offense characteristics, enhancements, and whatnot under Chapter 2. But that's where you stop. You don't include application notes 2C specifically says that that Chapter 3 adjustments have to be limited to the money laundering and aren't based on the underlying, in this case, drug trafficking. Your Honor, I guess I would also like to address why, address why Claudia is a participant. Also, Mike would be the other potential participant that the government is asking this court to find. Again, the standard is not whether there's sufficient evidence to show that that Mike is a participant, whether this court on de novo review would find that he's a participant. It's whether there's merely a reasonable probability that a district court could find as a fact that he wasn't a participant. And in this case, where Mike is not a member of the, we'll just call it the Pallone organization, that's the government's evidence. The government's witness testified to that. It's very clear. It's undisputed that Mike is not part of the Pallone organization. He's part of the cartel in Mexico. He works for the cartel. There's a good reason for not including him within the, counting him as a participant, where he's specifically part of a different organization. Generally in drug transactions, you do have, you can have these separate entities that are distinct organizations. You can have suppliers, and you can have the middlemen and the customers, none of whom are necessarily part of the same global conspiracy. It depends on sort of the interplay and how. So very clearly here, Pallone is involved in the in Mr. Arias Portillo's drug trafficking activity, as he absolutely knows where that money is being spent, what it's being used for, what he charges customers. He's actually involved in, and he shares the intent to distribute drugs. The cartel, who merely supplies the drugs, there's no evidence that they were involved in any degree to the further distribution of drugs. So as far as the cartel is concerned, they sell a large quantity, receive cash, and that's it.
But the thing that I'm struggling a little bit with your argument, and your points are very well taken, Mr. Rechambeau, but Mike is also a courier. Mike gets the cash and then he delivers it to, you're right, the cartel people. But and so maybe he's on a different team, but it seems to me that under even your account of the evidence, he's still a participant in the money laundering. He is getting the cash and delivering the cash to other people. It seems to all be part of the same money laundering scheme. Am I wrong about that?
Well, I think, and I would analogize to the drug trafficking context as opposed to the money laundering context, where you have parties can be, part of the same transaction, but not necessarily share in the same criminal activity. And that's the point here, because the money laundering, while it is Mike transporting the money to Mexico, and so the actus reus for both parties is the same, but money laundering elements are you know, transportation from place inside the United States to a place outside the United States for the purpose of specified unlawful criminal activity. So I think that element would be different. It's certainly conceivable that the cartel is involved in Colon's organization to the extent that they're one global conspiracy and would be considered participants to the same unlawful activity. But respectfully, that is for the district court to consider in the first instance, not for this court to decide for the first time on appeal. I see that I'm out of time. I would ask this court to remand for resentencing.
Thank you. Judge Seymour, do you have any questions? Judge Phillips, do you? Mr. Rachibeau, when I asked you that last question, I didn't realize you only had a minute left, so I cheated you out of your rebuttal, so I'm going to give you a minute. I apologize for doing that to you. Mr. Clark?
Good morning, Your Honors. Assistant United States Attorney Brian Clark, appearing on behalf of the United States. May it please the court. There's overwhelming evidence in the record that Mr. Arellanos-Portillo was a manager or supervisor with respect to money laundering. The district court found that he was a manager or supervisor because he, one, had direct contact with the drug trafficking organization's primary money courier, and that is Mike. And he used that contact with Mike to funnel money to him, which he then took to the drug trafficking organization suppliers in Mexico. And he did that on a regular basis, as the recorded telephone calls show.
Second, by that logic, Mr. Clark, any mule would be considered a manager or supervisor because they're the person with direct contact with the cartel that would be purchasing the drugs. Why is it the fact that he was simply the principal source of contact with another presumably lower level employee or contractor of the cartel, Mike, why would that lead to him being a manager or supervisor? Because it seems that none of the evidence is that Mr. Arellanos-Portillo is making any major decisions. The only decision that we know of was he wasn't able to get the cash, so he delayed Mike's trip to Wichita. That literally is the only decision, and the only decision was because of Pallone's instructions that you're supposed to get all the cash to Mike, and he didn't have the cash. So there are no decisions that he's making.
Well, and Mr. Arellanos-Portillo made arguments similar to that to the district court, which the district court rejected in its finding of fact. As a matter of fact, the district court found that Mr. Arellanos-Portillo was a manager or supervisor because Mr. Pallon wouldn't allow other people in the organization to contact Mike directly. But Mr. Arellanos-Portillo did have that authority, and he used it. That was a finding of fact that the district court made. And because this case is before the court on plain error review, this court typically doesn't second guess factual findings by the district court on plain error. But the second point is that the evidence does show that Mr. Arellanos-Portillo was not just a mule, but he was the cell head for the entire organization in Kansas City, that he made arrangements for money to go back to the cartels and for then drugs to come back to Kansas City. The district court spelled all of this out in its factual findings, and I think that's important because having considered all of these facts and arguments, the district court rejected them as a matter of fact and on plain error review. That's not something that this court typically second guesses. The second important finding I think that the district court made, in addition to Mr. Arellanos-Portillo's contact with Mike, was that Mr. Arellanos-Portillo directed subordinates within the organization to take money that he had gathered, drug proceeds, and take them to couriers who would then take the money to the cartels. That shows the fact that he can direct subordinates shows that he is a manager or supervisor with respect to money laundering. And then the third important finding.
Is there any evidence that he made those, that he was authorized to or did make those directions without Pallone telling him to instruct those other subordinates?
To be sure that, and as the district court agreed, that it appeared that Pallone was a bit of a micromanager, but there were instances where Mr. Arellanos-Portillo did make those decisions on his own. For example, there are calls where Pallone will tell Mr. Arellanos-Portillo, hey, you need to call Mike. And Arellanos-Portillo will say, hey, I already did that, already have things ready, he's coming at 6, or Mr. Arianez Portillo will tell Pallon, I have so-and-so who's going to do such-and-such. So it shows that Mr. Arianez Portillo is taking his own initiative and not simply a mouthpiece or simply following orders. And I think Diana Calzada's testimony at sentencing is really important on this point, because she testified that it was Mr. Arianez Portillo who would direct her husband, Julio Calzada, who's also known as Doc, to take trips to El Paso, to take money down to a courier there, and then to bring drugs back. It was also Mr. Arianez Portillo who would pay the Calzadas on a regular basis to use their garage to store money and also drugs. So it was Mr. Arianez Portillo who was acting, you know, like a true manager in any legitimate organization where there is a hub in Kansas City. There's lots of activity going on here. The leader of the organization, Pallon, is in Texas, and Mr. Arianez Portillo is running the day-to-day operations within Kansas City with direct contact with Pallon. And that's another factual finding that the district court made. And then I think a third important factual finding is that Mr. Arianez Portillo oversaw a network of stash houses in and around Kansas City. And those stash houses stored not just drugs, but also money. The money would stack up. Mr. Arianez Portillo would wait until they had enough. He would make a decision when they had enough money to call Mike. He would call Mike. Mike would either come, or Mr. Arianez Portillo would direct someone else to take the money to Mike at another location. And that's how the money laundering scheme worked. And I think it's incredibly important, Mr. Rochaveau's concession to you, Judge Bacharach, and the top side of this argument, that in determining a Chapter 3 adjustment under Section 2S1.1A1, as we have here, the district court can consider any activity that relates to money laundering. I think under that standard, this court should affirm and find that there's no error at all, because based on the district court's finding, and given that understanding that the district court is allowed to consider any money laundering activity at all, there's clearly five or more than five really participants involved. And they're people not just that the government is presenting in our brief, but people that the district court named itself. So Mr. Arianez Portillo agrees that the district court identified 7 people in the Pallon organization. Among those included 4 people with direct involvement in money laundering. And I say direct involvement, that's Mr. Arianez Portillo's concession in his plea petition that Mr. Arianez Portillo was involved in money laundering. So was Pallon. So was Julio Calzada, also known as Doc. And so was Peral. In addition to those, the district court acknowledged that Mike was involved in money laundering. He's the one who would take the money and from a delivery point at one time it was El Paso, one time it was Wichita. He would then take the money to the cartels in Mexico. That's 5 right there before you even get to Claudia or some of the other folks who may have been more peripheral to the money laundering offenses. And I think that's important. Because the government's view of Application Note 2C is that it does not bring about a substantial change in the way that the guidelines ordinarily operate. That is to say, it serves one pretty simple function. And the reason for it is exactly what you, Judge Phillips, were getting at and questioning about the premises liability. Under Section 2S1.1, A1, a money laundering defendant who is a direct money launderer like Mr. Arianez Portillo, the base offense level for his money laundering offense is determined by reference to the offense level of the underlying offense.
What do you mean offense level? Do you mean the base offense level like the PSR calculated, or do you mean the total offense level from the 2D1.1?
So to be clear, there are 2 separate parts of 2S1.1A1 that refer to offense level. It is the base offense level of the money laundering offense is determined by reference to the offense level of the underlying offense. So if I can unpack that, I think Mr. Rochebeau was correct in saying that the specific offense levels that are determined under Chapter 2 of the guidelines are incorporated, then pulled into the base offense level for money laundering. And then the question is, once you're there and you have these sort of nested offenses, the question is, what about Chapter 3 adjustments? And all Application Note 2C says is, for purposes of Chapter 3 adjustments, look to the money laundering offense and not to that underlying offense. There needed to be a provision that directed district courts which offense to use as the starting point.
Okay, you've gone past my question, but I'm not sure you've answered it.
I'm sorry.
I want to make sure at the end of the argument I understand your understanding of how this works.
Okay.
The PSR calculated the level 32 as the offense level that it's transferring over from the drug conviction. And that's the base offense level for that amount of drugs. Do you agree with the PSR that that is the starting place before we ever get to specific offense characteristics and adjustments?
No, I think the base offense level for the money laundering offense is the base offense level under 2D plus the premises enhancement under Chapter 2.
So you're saying that the PSR calculated it wrong?
Well, with respect, the PSR overruled the government's objection that the premises liability, those 2 points should be added. So that's why those 2 points are not in the PSR.
Let me tell you what I'm getting at, which is I see, and correct me if I'm wrong, a fundamental mistake in the PSR that has an effect, goes all the way through clear to the defendant's arguments here that we're going to have to sort out.
Okay.
And that is that under guideline 3D1.3A, when you have these 3D1.2C kind of grouping, you don't just mash them all together and add every base offense level and specific offense characteristic and adjustment from both of them. You calculate two separate stacks. You calculate the 2D1.1 stack. You calculate the 2S1.1 stack. And whichever one's bigger, you use that. That's how you group. But the PSR didn't do that. And the district court didn't do that. And maybe it hasn't been raised, and maybe there's nothing we can do about it, but it results in a lower sentence than the defendant's even asking for today. What do we do about that?
I think that's a fair criticism of both the approach that the PSR took as well as the approach that the district court took. That's not an argument that Mr. Arellanes-Portillo has raised. And it's not something that is presented before this court to resolve. I disagree, and I'm not sure how it would result in a lower sentence than what Mr. Arellanes-Portillo actually received.
Because the drug guideline is the taller stack, and you end up at total offense level 34.
Well, So maybe it would be easier for me to sort of walk through from the beginning how I think about the money laundering guideline provision and how it works. And I think that so if you start with a base offense level of 32, which is based on the drug quantities that the district court counted. Then you
And I'm going to track as you go with whether you're inconsistent or whether you're consistent with the PSR. So far, so good.
Okay. And this part will be a little bit different than the PSR because the PSR overruled the government's objection with respect to a drug involved premise.
You're out of luck on that, right? The district court imposed that and you didn't, and you lost.
Well, so the government, we prevailed.
Yeah. You got the two levels. All right, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay, so you start with the base offense level for the drug underlying offense, which is 32. You add to it the 2, which is for the drug-involved premises. That gets you to 34. That is the offense level for the underlying offense that then gets incorporated as the base offense level of the money laundering offense, that 34. You then add to it two levels for the specific offense characteristic for money laundering. And that gets you to 36. You then add to that three levels under chapter 3 for the role in the offense as a manager or organizer. And that gets you to 36. You then reduce it by 3 for acceptance of responsibility. And that gets you to the 36.
For the 2S1.1, when the guideline and the one that you've referred to, the base offense level, when it says the offense level for the underlying offense, you're adding the specific offense characteristics. Why aren't you adding the adjustment? Isn't that part of the offense level?
So that's where application note 2C comes in, because it says under the general rule under 1B1.5C, yes, chapter 3 would be calculated for the drug, and then that would be incorporated into the base offense level for money laundering. Mm-hmm. Application note 2C comes in and says, not for purposes of money laundering, though. For purposes of money laundering, for a direct money launderer sentenced under 2S1.1A1 only, we're going to say, don't apply the chapter 3 adjustments to the underlying offense. Determine the base offense level for money laundering first, and then apply the chapter 3 adjustments based on the money laundering offense after that. And I see my time is up. I would be happy to answer any other questions or be as helpful as I can be in explaining our position.
Thank you, Mr. Carr. Judge Phillips, do you have any other questions?
No, thank you.
Judge Seymour? I have one question for you, Mr. Clark. That is, as you just pointed out, nobody's raised this, but I had a question about how this would potentially bear on the issues that that Mr. Arellanos-Portillo is making. Because this argument, the theory of reversal is predicated solely on application note 2C, there's nothing in Mr. Rechabeau, he'd be able to correct me if I'm wrong about this, the argument itself is not predicated on the text of the guideline. Under Kaiser, there is a very now a much different gloss than we had on the R doctrine in terms of interpreting application notes. And I just wonder if Kaiser affects the degree of materiality of application note 2C. Does Kaiser's potential bearing on the applicability of the application notes themselves have any bearing on this appeal or no?
You know, I can't speak directly to Kaiser's applicability and what effect that might have. That's not something that I had thought about, but this court did address how application note 2C specifically and how application notes in general ought to be read in conjunction with the other guidelines. And with respect, Mr. Arellanos-Portillo asks this court to basically wipe out the relevant conduct guideline because of something that is tucked in an application note in a money laundering guideline, when really all of them can be read in harmony, because as I was discussing with Judge Phillips, that word offense in application note 2C is important because that would immediately refer a sentencing judge to the relevant conduct guideline, which also uses the word offense. And then it's the relevant conduct guideline that tells district courts what facts they can or cannot consider when sentencing someone for a particular offense. So even setting to the side Kaiser, and I'm sorry, I can't be more helpful on that point, Judge Bacharach, but I think even setting that to the side, the application note actually has very limited work to do or weight here because it does not, in the government's view, affect this substantial.
Well, you can't accept and reject this, the absolute same words at the same time when it says, unless stated otherwise, as the start of application note 2C. You can't say, I'm just going to pretend that that doesn't exist. I'm going to apply the rest of it. And I'm going to argue to the panel that the rest of it, redacting those three words and make my argument on behalf of the government. If you do endorse the idea of applying Application Note 2C, then we have to apply the entirety of Application Note 2C. Do you agree with that?
I agree with that. I think the entirety of Application Note 2C, quite frankly, supports our position, because those first initial words, unless otherwise specified, so those appear in a couple of different places. One place that appears is in the relevant conduct guideline in 1B1.3, but that's referring to other guidelines that tell district courts what conduct to consider. The Application Note 2C doesn't tell what district courts what conduct to consider. It tells district courts what offense to use, underlying offense or the money laundering offense. It doesn't limit what evidence or what conduct district courts can consider. Those words appear something to that effect at the beginning of Application Note 2C. Importantly, it says, notwithstanding 1B1.5, and one would think if Application Note 2C were intended to displace relevant conduct, which is 1B1.3, it would have said notwithstanding 1B1.3 and 1B1.5, but it didn't do that. Instead, all it did was displace one default rule in 1B1.5C, and that's all. And so in the government's view, all of the guidelines, the application note, both relevant conduct, 1B1.5C, can all be read in harmony to allow district courts to actually consider a breadth of evidence in determining whether a Chapter 3 adjustment applies to a money laundering offense, and really just to apply the ordinary rules to it instead of coming up with a separate, different set of rules for money laundering.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate that. Mr. Rashebo, you do have, I did give you a little bit of rebuttal time. Oh, you're on mute.
By definition, the underlying criminal conduct of the money laundering offense is relevant conduct. Under Application Note 2C, it only applies where the defendant is the primary or is the direct money launderer. So it only applies under A1 where they have either committed the underlying offense or the underlying or responsible for it under relevant conduct. So the government's theory that that of course you can consider any of this so long as it's relevant conduct would render that application note a nullity, because there would be no situation where you couldn't consider the underlying offense. Judge Phillips' question, 1B1.5 says that when an instruction to use the offense level from another offense guideline refers to the offense level, an instruction to use the offense level from another offense guideline refers to the offense level from the entire offense guideline, i.e. the base offense level, specific offense characteristics, cross-references, and special instructions. So that's why when you're incorporating the underlying criminal offense into the money laundering guideline calculation, you do include all the Chapter 2 adjustments, but then Application Note 2C specifically says you stop there. And despite the general rule of 1B1.5C, you don't count the underlying offense when determining the Chapter 3 adjustments. So that's why we draw that distinction right there. And I see that I'm over time, and if there are no further questions, then I'd ask this court to remand from the sentencing.
Judge Phillips, do you have any additional questions?
No, thanks.
Okay, Judge Seymour, do you? All right. Thank you both, Mr. Rashebo and Mr. Clark, for your excellent briefs and argument today. This matter will be submitted. We'll